Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
On the morning of August 27th, 1992, the remnants of Hurricane Andrew were heading toward Tupelo, Mississippi. Inside a small house on Honey Locust Drive, a 13-year-old girl named Lee Ochi was home alone, still in her nightgown. She had an open house at her middle school later that day, and her mom had just left for work. Around 8:30, her mother was worried about the storm, so she called home to check on Lee, but there was no answer. She called again, still no answer. So she made the mile and a half drive home. She'd been gone less than an hour, but when she got home, Lee was gone. In the 34 years since that morning, there has never been an arrest, but there have been a few people who have never quite been ruled out. Can new searches finally bring the answers that have been hidden for over three decades? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Lee Ochi. I'm Conan Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Now, this week's episode accidentally became a two-parter, which is why it's coming out a little late for my Patreon members.
Sorry
about that. I was about 80-85% finished with it, but then I ended up going down a rabbit hole, and that rabbit hole is now going to be part two of this episode.
It's been a while since we've had a two-part episode, though.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I really just went nuts this season and started it with like two-parters in a row, which was insane.
Yeah.
But yeah, we haven't had one since then. So, you know, figured why not? Now, without giving too much away right off the bat, there are a few names that consistently come up in this case. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of them, and next week, we'll dive into the other. But don't fear, if you're a Patreon member, you will be able to access part two early, so I'm not going to leave you hanging for that long. I usually try to get both parts up at the same time, but just, again, because we got kind of behind, there might be a little bit of a wait for part two, but you still won't have to wait a week. So speaking of Patreon, before we get into it, we've had a few folks join us over there, so we'd like to take a moment to give them a shout out. Thank you to Survivor Tools, Sydney M, Kristen F, and Amanda. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you so much.
As a reminder, if you'd like to get our episodes ad-free and usually early, just, you know.
Usually
early. I've been really good about it this season. You can join us over there on Patreon at any level, starting at just $2 a month. You'll also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. So now let's get into part one of the story of Lee Ochi. Lee Maureen Ochi was born on August 21st, 1979 in Honolulu, Hawaii to Vicki Felton and Donald Ochi. Donald and Vicki met in 1977 in California, where they were both serving in the U.S. Army. According to Donald, Vicki was stationed at the Defense Language Institute/Foreign Language Center in Monterey. There, she studied Korean and interrogation techniques and became a trained interrogator.
Oh, that's fancy.
Yeah. And he ended up joining the Rapid Deployment Unit, which I think is also, I don't know a lot about this, I mean, but I think that's also like kind of a big deal.
I don't know either. It sounds cool.
Yeah, right. Within a year of meeting, the couple was married and they were both stationed in Hawaii, where Lee was born shortly thereafter. I never understood why every time I told people when I was a kid that I was born in Hawaii, they would always ask me if my parents were military.
Well, because like there's a lot of military.
Yeah, I didn't know that though. And I was always so confused. I'm like, no, my parents have never done anything remotely like that. They just, you know, decided to move out of Detroit.
Well, typically, people usually only move to Hawaii if they're military or they join a commune, like your parents did. Yeah. Or created their own.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm like, please, they didn't join anything. My dad created it. Unfortunately, Vicki and Donald's marriage began to deteriorate not long after Lee was born, and the pair split while she was still a baby. Donald continued to serve in the Army and was stationed around the country and even around the world. Vicky transitioned at some point to the National Guard, and she and Lee settled in Tupelo, Mississippi. Donald remarried and has expressed regret that the geography of his job kept him from seeing Lee as often as he would have liked. While he was stationed in Germany, however, Lee flew overseas and spent the summer with him. At one point, he was also stationed in Kentucky, which he said made it easier for him to spend time with her. By the summer of 1992, Donald and his wife had a daughter of their own and were stationed in Virginia. Vicky had also remarried. Her husband was a younger man named Barney Yarborough. He was around 29, while Vicky was around 37. The couple both worked at Leggett & Platt, a manufacturing company near their home at 105 Honey Locust Drive in Tupelo. Lee was getting ready to start the 8th grade at Tupelo Middle School. She loved horses and horseback riding and was known to be a high-energy kid who often got in trouble for talking or fidgeting in school. She was outgoing, but she seemed to have an easier time talking to adults than to kids her own age. She had a few close friends, but a lot of the kids said she was a little weird. Donald described his daughter as witty and affectionate, but said she was a little standoffish. He said, though, that he was also standoffish, so he wasn't sure if it was because of genetics or because of her situation. Yeah, and that was his words, her situation.
What is her situation?
Well, I don't know exactly what he meant by that. He didn't really clarify, but we will talk a little bit about her home life, and you can make your own inferences. By his own admission, Donald wasn't around much. Like I said, he was in the rapid deployment unit, so he was just moving, I think, even more than a typical person in the Army would move. So he didn't really have a clear, like, day-to-day picture of Lee's home life. And it doesn't really sound like he and Vicky had a very friendly relationship either. So it seems as though he was pretty out of the loop. He would only talk to his daughter on the phone once or twice a month, and he said that Lee never said much during those conversations. Now, there could be a million reasons for that. Some kids are just age. Yeah, exactly. She was 12, 13. She had just turned 13, right? So, like, yeah, kids generally suck on the phone, I feel like, when you call them and you're their parents. So it could just be something as simple as that. But Donald did say that he always had the impression that Vicky was just, like, right there listening. Now, because of his distance, Donald probably didn't know much about the rumors that had been going around school prior to Lee's disappearance. According to a number of friends and classmates, Lee often came to school with bruises.
Okay.
One friend, a kid named John Bradley, who rode the bus with her, said that he remembers her coming on and having bruises all up and down her legs. He said that whenever he would ask her about it, she had an excuse. She fell, she ran into something, like whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like bruises all up and down your legs, like, yeah, that is normal for a lot of kids. It could be indicative of absolutely nothing. Or...
Well, I mean, it really depends on how many bruises and where the bruises are on your legs. I mean, like, typically if you fall down, you're not going to get a whole lot of bruising on the back of your thighs.
Yeah. However, there was a more alarming incident. One day, Lee showed up to school with a bruised face and a black eye. When asked what happened, she said that she was kicked in the face by a horse.
A horse?
A horse.
Oh. I mean, you don't survive that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if you're someone who spends a lot of time around horses, which it does say that sound like Lee did, injuries absolutely happened.
Oh, totally.
Right? Like, my mom worked with horses for years for most of my childhood, and she got wrecked. Like, broken ribs. I mean, a lot of injuries that honestly could have been viewed as, like, abuse, potentially.
Sure, but did she ever get kicked in the face?
No, because you don't get kicked in the face, like, and just get a black eye.
Right.
Like, your skull gets...
crushed.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, that is bad. And Lee was little. She was 4'10" and 95 pounds.
Yeah.
Like, no.
Yeah, she doesn't survive a kick to the face by a horse.
And if you survive, you're certainly just not showing up at school with a black eye.
Right.
And so even her friend was like, that absolutely did not happen. Like, he immediately was like, no, you did not get kicked in the face by a horse. And he said he was sure that the school was going to get involved because clearly something happened at home. But it doesn't seem that they ever did. So because of this, like, I cannot absolutely say that Lee was being abused. All I'm saying is that people who knew her had that fear. So let's get to the morning of Thursday, August 27th, 1992. Hurricane Andrew was a devastating storm that had ripped through Florida and honestly flattened parts of it. On this day, the remnants were pushing through Mississippi. Now, they weren't in grave danger in Tupelo, but the rain and the winds were heavy. Vicky had work that day, and Lee was staying home. At some point later, like in the afternoon, Lee's grandmother was supposed to pick her up and take her to an open house at her middle school, because this is like the last couple days of summer break. So I think it was an open house, you know, to meet the teachers kind of do that stuff, probably get your locker assignment, like all that good stuff. So that was the plan for the afternoon. And then Lee and Vicky were supposed to get dinner at Taco Bell and, you know, talk about the day. So that morning before she went to work, Vicky and Lee had breakfast together. Lee was still wearing her nightgown, and the two chatted about their plans for the day. Vicky left for work a little bit before 8 a.m. But shortly after she arrived at work, Vicky learned that the storm was heading toward Tupelo and that the Gulf Coast was under a hurricane alert. Around 8:30, she called home to check on Lee. Now, this was before caller ID, or if it wasn't, it was before they had caller ID. So they had a code that let Lee know that it was her mother calling and that she could answer the phone. Vicky would call, let the phone ring twice, hang up, and then call back again. And that's such a funny detail to me because, like, my parents and I had the exact same code when I was a kid.
My parents did not.
Yeah.
I would answer the phone whenever it rang.
Yeah, no, we had that same code because I was left alone a lot. So Vicky called using their code, but Lee didn't answer. She tried again. Still nothing. So she got in her car and drove the mile and a half home. When she arrived home a few minutes later, Vicky immediately noticed that things were different. The garage door was open, and crucially, the garage light was on. Now, this is the light that's connected to the garage door opener, and it automatically turns on when the garage door opens. But it automatically shuts off after about 5 minutes. So the fact that it was still on indicated that the door had just been opened minutes before.
Unless the beam going across, the safety beam going across the bottom is tripped.
Yeah, it didn't seem like it was though.
Like I also don't know when that technology came out. So I don't know if that was around in 92.
No, from all accounts, it seems like it was on because it had just been opened.
Okay.
When she went inside the house, Vicky was met with a chilling scene. It's been a busy summer, and I don't know about you, but my routine has definitely taken a hit these past couple months. Now that I'm actually home for more than a few days, I'm ready to start eating real food and, you know, looking at a vegetable again. That's why I'm so happy that my Factor box just got delivered today. Factor meals are ready in 2 minutes and require no prep and no cleanup. So even on the days when your schedule is completely out of control, eating well is still achievable. Every week, you'll find over 100 nutrient-dense menu items to choose from, and they fit a variety of dietary needs. Right before recording this, I literally just finished my favorite meal from Factor, which is their miso edamame tofu salad. It was absolutely amazing. I actually got two of them in my box this week. So let's eat real. Head to factormeals.com/ATTWG50off and use code ATTWG50off to get 50% off and one free breakfast item per box for 1 year while supplies last until 10/31/2026. That's code ATTWG50off at factormeals.com. ATTWG50off at factormeals.com. See website for more details. You know I love a good mystery, but not when it comes to what's going on with my body. Yet even when I go to the doctor, it seems like I still don't get the answers I'm looking for. Most people who get blood work done hit the same wall. The results come back, they get a nod, and everything looks fine, and they're sent on their way. Jevity is the first all-in-one precision health membership that closes that gap. Your membership includes access to a functional health expert and longevity clinician who review your blood work and build a personalized protocol. Jevity sent a phlebotomist to my house to take my blood, and they tested everything from cholesterol, blood pressure, to my cortisol levels and my thyroid. They even do a gut microbiome analysis. Jevity gives you a personalized plan, so 93% of members see meaningful improvement from their first to second round of blood work. And we have an exclusive offer for our listeners who want to try it for themselves. Go to gojevity.com/gone and use promo code ATTWG for 20% off your purchase. That's gojevity.com/gone and use promo code ATTWG for 20% off your purchase. I'm really excited to tell you, we've got another banger from Kensington Publishing and author Noelle W. Eiley, who wrote Ask for Andrea. Her new book, Gray After Dark, is incredible. It's a thriller that's inspired by a real crime, the 1984 abduction of Olympic biathlete Carrie Swenson, who was kidnapped and left stranded in the wilderness by her attackers. The story follows Miley, an injured Olympic hopeful who's spending the summer training in Idaho's remote Frank Church wilderness when she's abducted during a morning run. Suddenly, she's trapped in an off-grid cabin miles from help, forced to rely on her athletic training, instincts, and sheer determination to stay alive. This book doesn't come out till June 30th, but I was so excited to get an early copy. And what I loved is it's not just a thriller about escaping a captor. It's also a battle against wilderness itself. Miley's stuck in the woods and realizing that surviving one more day is far from guaranteed. So if you're a fan of Freda McFadden, Karen Slaughter, John Mars, or true crime stories, Gray After Dark absolutely deserves a spot on your list. Inside, Vicky saw blood smeared on the wall. She went room to room calling for her daughter. In Lee's bedroom, she told CNN, quote, her favorite blanket was crumpled up on the floor, and I was very scared, end quote. After checking around the house and finding it empty, she called the police at about 9 a.m. Officers responded immediately. Lee had been alone for less than an hour. So remember, she called about 8:30.
Right.
Twice. Didn't get an answer, got in her car, got home. She got home probably around like 8:45 or so.
Yeah.
So she only spent 15 minutes looking around. And so she called police very quickly. And again, she left like 7:45 for work. So whatever happened in that house, according to Vicky, took place in about an hour.
And didn't you say Vicky remarried?
Yes.
Are we going to get to her husband?
Yes.
Okay. Then I will save my questions.
Right. In case you are already coming up with theories in your head, there's something that I want to mention right off the bat. In addition to the blood smeared on the wall, there were fresh, still wet stains on the walls, the carpet, and the bathroom countertop. There was also blood and hair stuck to a door frame. This suggested to investigators that Lee's head had struck it or had been struck against it. Now, interestingly, in the bathroom, it appeared as though somebody had tried to clean up. But police never found a used rag or towel anywhere in the house, so whoever cleaned took that with them. Now, the bathroom sink wasn't the only evidence of a cleanup, though. The nightgown that Lee's mother says she was wearing that morning when she left for work,
yeah,
was found bloodstained inside of her laundry hamper, along with the bloodstained bra, presumably the one that Lee had been wearing. Then investigator, later police chief, Bart Aguirre, later told the Associated Press that because blood appeared to have dripped down onto the nightgown, the injury that caused it was likely above the neck, meaning a head wound, which does fit with the blood and the hair from the doorframe.
Right.
So it sounds like, you know, she hit the doorframe. She was hit against the doorframe, however that happened, while she was wearing the nightgown. And then either changed or was made to change or was changed by someone else.
Right.
So there's a lot about this scene to take in. And a lot of things that are kind of confusing because the timeline is so tight. If we're taking everything at face value, all of this would have had to have happened in less than an hour. Which to me, the only way that that could really happen would be if somebody was watching the house.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Like, I can't imagine that somebody was just, you know, wandering by with murder on their minds and was like, hey, ding dong.
This is definitely somebody was watching the house and had something planned.
Right.
Whether it's murder, rape, kidnapping.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
And given that there was an attempt to clean, mm-hmm. The head injury was probably not part of that plan.
Right. Yeah. It seems like whatever happened in that house got out of hand.
It seems like Lee put up a fight.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Considering that the bloodstains were in like different rooms, you know, like this wasn't a focused attack.
Right.
Like, this is somebody who was fighting back, who was running, who, you know, like, this was a fight.
So it's early morning-ish.
Yeah.
Neighbors, did anybody hear anything?
No, because most of them were at work. So a lot of them were gone. And then, yeah, the storm and everything was so loud, like, nobody was outside. Nobody, you know, could hear anything.
And nobody saw anything.
Yeah, no. So it does seem like somebody was watching the house. They saw Vicky leave and they're like, okay, this is my chance. And then whatever happened in the house happened and they were able to get out within minutes of Vicky coming back.
Via the garage,
yeah.
That might also have been the entry point.
It might have been.
Was there any sign of forced entry on any of the doors?
None.
So again, with that, the safety sensor on the bottom of the garage, like, that might have been the entry point. Fight happens in the house. He drags Lee out through the garage, which is already open for however that happened.
Yeah.
For him to gain access. And then as he's running out, it trips that sensor, which turns the light on again.
Yeah. And both of Lee's parents said that she wouldn't have opened the door to a stranger. So they believe that whoever was at the door was somebody that Lee would have opened the door to at, you know, 8 a.m. while wearing a nightgown.
So, should I ask again?
Well, we're going to get to it. All right, so let's get back to the scene. There wasn't forced entry, nothing like that. Garage door was open. That's kind of what we know about the house. There's nothing in the garage that indicated any struggle there.
But was there blood on the hallway leading to the garage?
I'm not sure what hallway it was.
All right.
I will say it was like not a large house, though. So, you know, it was probably relatively close to the garage in any case. Vicky told police that there wasn't anything missing from the house either. So it didn't seem like a home invasion, you know, for burglary purposes. But she told police that a new outfit, including a new bra and underwear that Lee had just gotten for her birthday the week prior, were missing.
So maybe what she was forced to change into.
Right.
Or what somebody put on her.
Yeah. At some point, the perpetrator tried to clean up some of the mess, which was evidenced in the bathroom, but perhaps realizing that it was futile, gave up because there just was a lot of blood everywhere. So, you know, the thought was like maybe they started to clean up and then was like, what's the point? Like, there's no cleaning this up.
Right.
The other possibility that I haven't really seen anywhere but kind of popped into my head as I was writing this is that the cleanup in the bathroom wasn't from trying to clean up the scene itself. What if Lee fought back and injured the person who attacked her? Maybe the person went to the bathroom to try to clean themselves up and then wiped up the sink in an effort to not leave their own blood behind.
Mm, good possibility.
You know, like, because I can see you going to the bathroom, looking in the mirror, seeing how bad it is, trying to clean yourself up, and then cleaning up the mess that you've made there.
But who cares about her blood that's all over the house?
Right. Because obviously she's going to be missing, so they would expect it to be her blood.
Well, yeah, that does actually make sense, because, like, why would he also have left the bloody nightgown and the bloody bra there if he was worried about cleaning up the scene?
But taking the towels that they used to clean it up.
Because it had his blood on it, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I did find the detail of the nightgown and the bra being put in the hamper to be interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard that Vicky was kind of a neat freak. And so I'm wondering if Lee, at the end of this, was still conscious and was made to change.
Good possibility.
And just out of habit put her stuff in the hamper.
Yeah.
Even though she's in the middle of this like horrible traumatic event, just kind of on autopilot did that. Because it struck me as weird, and it struck a lot of people as weird, you know, over the years, that like a perpetrator would take the time to like put her clothes in the hamper.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that's why a lot of people are like, it is weird that the idea that a stranger came in and did this, because why would a stranger take the time to clean up? Why would a stranger put the clothes in the hamper? Which are valid, but again, I think the stranger was cleaning up after themselves.
I don't think it was a stranger, or at the very least, I don't think it was.
Well, yeah, and by stranger, I mean not Vicky.
Gotcha. I mean, it had to have been somebody that knew Vicky's schedule, that knew when she'd be out of the house.
Or had an idea, right? Or yeah. At least just knew that she would go to work and had been waiting and watching the house, knowing that she would leave at some point to go to work. You know,
It was targeted either way.
I absolutely do think it was targeted. Along with her new outfit, there are two other things missing. Lee's reading glasses and a sleeping bag that she always kept in her room. If Lee had been wearing the glasses, maybe you would take them because, you know, she was still conscious and she was still wearing them. And that's just not something you would have necessarily thought about. But if she wasn't wearing them, like, why grab them? Did Lee herself somehow have the wherewithal to grab them? And same thing with the sleeping bag. Was that taken because this was a kidnapping, or was it used to roll up a body?
But if it was used to roll up the body, again, why dress her?
Right. Why dress her? Why put her clothes in the hamper?
Right.
Why get the glasses?
Yeah.
Police are trying to puzzle all of this together while also starting a search. The thought was that Lee could have been injured and wandered off, or that she could have been dumped somewhere nearby. Because again, it's just such a short timeline. They were like, she couldn't have gotten far, you know?
Right.
So police hit the streets. They even brought in bloodhounds, but the storm was raging to the point where they were basically useless. Detective Aguirre told CNN that the dogs covered a half-mile radius from the house that morning, but came up with nothing. Organized searches through the wooded areas around Tupelo also found nothing. DNA testing was in its infancy at the time, so in terms of forensics, all the police could do was blood typing. Every sample that they took from the scene came back as type O, the same type as Lee. Neighbors were interviewed, but a lot of them were at work, like I said, and no one reported seeing anything suspicious that morning.
I have questions about blood type.
Okay.
Do we know what blood type Vicky was, or what blood type her father was, or what blood type Vicky's husband was?
I do not know the blood type of any of them.
Okay.
I did look it up. As the mother of somebody with an O blood type, you could also have an O blood type. You could also have A or B. You just couldn't be AB.
Right.
So, yeah, I do not know. I assume the police know.
We would hope.
Yeah. But no, I'm not sure. And I'm not sure about her stepfather or her father either. Now, of course, police interviewed Vicky and Barney, the stepfather, first. Despite the rumors of abuse, Barney was actually cleared pretty quickly. Interestingly, he wasn't living at home on Honey Locust at the time of Lee's disappearance. He and Vicky had separated about a month prior.
Because of abuse?
I don't know. I've never seen any public reason given for the split. According to investigators, Barney had an airtight alibi for that morning. They've never specified what it was, but my guess is that he was seen at work. He worked at the same manufacturing plant as Vicky. So I'm thinking that he was there probably, you know, at the same time and people saw him.
And Vicky's alibi?
Well, yeah, I mean, same thing. And it seems like she was alibied for being at work when she said she was and left when she said she did. Now, police also gave them polygraphs. Barney passed his. Vicky did not. As for Donald, his story is interesting. According to an interview he did in 2017 for the podcast 13, The Search for Leo Chi, he said that he found out that Lee was missing from Vicky, but not until the next day. He says that Vicky called him and told him that Lee had run away.
Oh, okay. I was given a little bit of a cushion there or whatever. Like, I could understand, like, Vicky not calling him right away because, he's
in Virginia.
Who the hell knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, at least that's where his home is. He might have been deployed somewhere.
Sure, yeah.
So I could see that, like...
Yeah, like, what are you going to do?
She's dealing with the immediate...
Yeah, and they don't even like each other from what it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
But then to tell him that she ran away, at least that's according to him.
That is according to him. Also according to him, he was like, okay, so that's what she told me. He says that he just assumed that Lee was off with friends and just told Vicky to call everyone that, you know, Lee knows, right? But then he said he started calling Vicky every day to find out what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, if Vicky did tell him that, it's a convenient way to let him know that his daughter isn't at home, but it's not really an emergency. You don't really need to look into it.
Exactly. You don't need to come down here, right. Like, whatever.
But we're sure that Donald was in Virginia at the time.
Yes, police did verify that.
Okay.
So, yeah, so Vicky called him, told him that Lee had run away, didn't mention the blood. And so he's like, oh, yeah, she's probably with friends. You know, let me know what happens, right? Keeps on calling her back, asking for updates. Vicky doesn't have any. On what he remembers as a Friday, so potentially like a week after Lee went missing, he said to her, well, what have you guys found out? And he says it was only then that she told him, well, when she disappeared, there was blood everywhere.
I mean, I would be fucking furious.
Well, yeah. So that's when he's like, okay, well, obviously this is not just
It's her. Not a runaway.
It's not a runaway, right? Like, there's not blood everywhere when you run away. And so that's when he and his wife and their baby came down to Tupelo. Right around this time, on September 4th, which was 8 days after Lee vanished, a McDonald's worker in Boonville, Mississippi, about 30 miles north of Tupelo, reported seeing a girl who looked like Lee in a vehicle at the drive-thru. Police ran the tip down, but it ended up being another child. So they were actually able to find who it was and identify the kid.
Damn. That, I mean,
which
that's,
is wild. Yeah. Like, I don't even know how they would have done that.
Back in 92?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
But that's not the last time Boonville comes up in the story. 5 days later, on September 9th, an envelope arrived in the mail at the house on Honey Locust Drive. The envelope was addressed to B. Yarborough, who was Lee's stepfather, Barney Yarborough. His name, however, was misspelled. So it's just the letter B and then Yarborough, but Yarborough was spelled wrong. The street name, Honey Locust, was also misspelled. The envelope had 6 stamps, which was twice the postage needed, and it was postmarked from Boonville.
Extra postage is typical of, in my line of work, we call it nut mail.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a strong indicator that it's a suspicious item.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Extra postage, misspelled words on letters or packages, bizarre writings on the packages, stains on the packages or letters, all of those are indicators that it's a suspicious letter.
That's so interesting. I mean, like the stains, the markings or sure. Writings like that makes sense. But I wouldn't have thought extra postage. To me, that would just tell me that they were too lazy to go to the post office and just like put a bunch of stamps on and hope for the best.
Nope. We see it on pretty much any time anybody sends a threat letter.
That's so interesting. Yeah, that obviously never occurred to me. So inside the envelope were Lee's missing glasses. But that was it. There was no note, no ransom demand. There was nothing else at all. Yes.
Fingerprints? Did they fingerprint test?
Yes. The FBI took over forensics for that envelope.
Well, good. This is clearly a kidnapping at this point.
Exactly. Tupelo police said they didn't even bother with the state lab. They sent it straight to Quantico. But despite that, nothing of value was found. Handwriting analysis went nowhere, and there were no fingerprints. They held out hope that they could get DNA from the stamps or the envelope. But they had all been moistened with water, not saliva. So that, too, was a dead end. Now, this is another little bit of evidence that struck me. A lot of the write-ups on this case talk about how this is indicative of the sophistication of the sender.
No, it's just somebody that you don't have to be that sophisticated to understand how you can leave evidence.
Right. And so I think, yeah, you're right. In terms of fingerprints, like, yeah, I think it's pretty common knowledge, like wear gloves or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But the DNA is a different story because this is 1992. DNA was in its infancy. It had first been successfully used in the U.S. in 1987 to convict a serial rapist in Florida. But in 1992, not a lot of members of the general public knew about it. DNA in relation to criminal trials didn't really hit the mainstream consciousness until the O.J. Simpson trial 3 years later in 1995.
So to me, a couple of things. First, this does fit with your theory of the person trying to clean up their own blood in the bathroom.
How so?
Well, because if they are aware of DNA and their blood is in the bathroom, they cleaned it up and took the towel that they used to clean it up with.
Yeah.
They were very aware of that. So to me, that doesn't necessarily mean sophistication. It means somebody that has a prior history.
Interesting. Yeah. And to be fair, like, but the towel thing might not have been an awareness of DNA specifically, but an awareness that blood evidence can be used
right
in trials.
Yeah. It, to me, all of this points to somebody that has been involved with the law on the wrong side.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility. So yeah, so a lot of people, again, when you read about this case online, a lot of people have come to the conclusion that the person moistened the envelope and the stamps with water because they were aware of DNA and they were trying to avoid that. But I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think that you're right, that you could be right in general, right? With like, they do have an awareness of not wanting to leave evidence. I don't think that they necessarily had DNA specifically within that thought process, because the whole moistening everything with water thing, I think, isn't related to that at all. So when I was younger, I worked admin in a lot of offices. And I even worked for a temp agency for a while. So like, I ended up being in a variety of offices in a variety of industries. And one thing that I remember clearly is that nobody ever licked stamps or envelopes. Now, just for those of you who are like, well, yeah, nobody licks stamps because they're stickers. They were not at
they
the
weren't.
Time. You did have to lick it just like an envelope, but nobody did. What you had was a little plastic dish that you would put water in, and it came with a tiny sponge that you would then put in the water and you'd use the sponge on the stamps and the envelopes.
Like they used to have at grocery store cashiers.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Oh.
To count the money.
Oh, to count the money to wet their fingers.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the bill. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Right. But we would have them in like every office I was ever in would have them, because if you're sending out a bunch of stuff, like you're not wanting to lick 50 envelopes, like that's gross.
Mm-hmm.
So you would do this. It would be faster. It'd be less disgusting. And that's just what you did. And, you know, I also think that when we're like reading about these stories or listening to them or whatever, that we picture like the bad guy in a secret lair somewhere putting these things together to taunt the police. But when I had admin work to do, like in my personal life, like I needed to send something out or make copies or print something, I would always take it to the office and use the supplies there. So what if the person who sent those glasses just did that? They took them to work, popped them in an envelope, put some stamps on, and dropped them into a mailbox in Boonesboro.
It's a good possibility.
Regardless of the hows and whys, Detective Aguirre later told the AP that he believed the glasses were a deliberate distraction. He said that if they had been sent by an actual kidnapper, that they would have sent more than just the glasses. They would have asked for something. But like, what would be the point of just sending the glasses?
Proof of life, perhaps, or proof of having her. But again,
but to what end?
Well, without any additional notes for ransom or anything like that, then there is no point.
People who have suspected Vicky say that maybe she did it in order to point the police in the direction of Boonesboro and away from her and away from Tupelo in general. But, I mean, did it really? Like, Boonesboro was 30 miles away. Like, yeah, you know, I think it's right. clear that anybody could have driven and stuck an envelope in a mailbox. That doesn't necessarily mean they were from there at all.
Right. Well, but also, I mean, I know you said Vicky failed the polygraph, but her alibi stands that she was at work.
Right. So, and it would have been so tight.
Right.
For her to do any of that.
Unless she did it the night before.
Right, which was always what I thought, but police say that the blood was still wet.
Well, I mean, she could have done it in the early morning hours before she left for work, too. But then again, where did she take her?
Right. Another question.
Or she could have had help with it and set it up. But why?
Why? Yeah. And who would have helped her?
Yeah, I don't know. She seems like an unlikely suspect at this point. However, not off the list.
Yeah, definitely not. Years later, Detective Aguirre told CNN that those glasses were the last real clue that the case ever produced. Now, the next biggest development came in November 1993, 14 months after Lee's disappearance. And this one is awful. And really, all of you listening now, if you listened to our episode a few weeks back on Patty Otto, the one with the Finley Creek Jane Doe and the whole skull identification thing, get this. A farmer found a human skull in a ditch along a soybean field in Monroe County. On November 9th, the Clarion Ledger reported that the coroner had positively identified it through dental records as Lee Ochi. It was in the newspaper. Positively identified were the words that they used. Then just a few days later, like 2 to 3 days later, that identification was retracted.
Okay, where was the mistake? Obviously, well, in the coroner's office.
But yeah, obviously. Apparently, they had been working from outdated dental records. Further testing established that the skull actually belonged to a woman named Pollyanna Sue Keith, a 27-year-old woman who had gone missing from an adjacent county in March of 1993.
How do you mix up the dental records of a 13-year-old to a 27-year-old?
Right? And she had just turned 13 6 days earlier. So she's like barely 13.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's still wisdom teeth in there, the 13-year-old.
Yeah.
The skull would have to be a smaller size. Things aren't formed entirely.
Right. And it makes less sense to make that mistake because they were working with outdated dental records of Lee's, meaning dental records from when she was even younger.
Yeah.
Like, what?
That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense, but they announced it publicly and had Lee's family thinking that her skull was in a field. So interestingly, 8 months later, I found a letter to the editor that Vicky wrote to the paper because the same medical examiner fucked up again.
Jesus.
A little girl had been murdered, and the ME said that she had been raped prior to being murdered, and then came back and was like, oh, wait, no, never mind. She hadn't been assaulted.
What?
Yeah. And so Vicky wrote a letter and was like, oh, hey, also, this same person said that they found my daughter's skull 8 months ago, and they didn't. Like, maybe the medical examiner's office needs to be looked at.
Yeah, no shit.
Right?
Jesus.
Like, isn't that insane?
Yeah. That's completely insane.
Yeah, so that makes me doubt, you know, like, a lot in general in life. But yeah. Despite the fact that this case had a crime scene, which very few of our stories have, the investigation really didn't get very far. But there were, of course, plenty of people to look at. We already talked about Lee's stepfather, Barney. Interestingly, he doesn't actually come up in this story much. He participated in a few of the early searches. I've seen some news footage, and you can see him out there in fields looking. But he and Vicky never reconciled, and they ended up getting divorced a few years after Lee's disappearance. Like I said, police also cleared him pretty early on, so he just ended up being not much of a factor in this somehow. Barney ended up dying of cancer in 1996.
Damn.
Yeah, he was just 34 years old. One obituary mentioned Vicky as his former wife, but Lee wasn't included in it. Lee's father, Donald Ochi, was stationed in Virginia at the time. He ended up spending about a month in Tupelo searching for his daughter in fields and forests until his leave and his money ran out. He also passed a polygraph and was ruled out as a suspect by police. Because again, it was just pretty clear.
He was out of state.
Yeah, and it was clear that he was out of state, you know. So what does he think happened? In a 1998 Clarion Ledger article, he was blunt, telling them, quote, "I thought she was dead the day my ex-wife called me and told me she was missing. My theory is that some bastard beat that child to death in the house," end quote. As for what happened to Lee after that, he says that he thinks she's still in or around Tupelo. Quote, "You have that big river running up through there. She could have been thrown off that big bridge," end quote. He later told the Associated Press that while he was searching Tupelo in September 1992, multiple locals pulled him aside and told him to look at Lee's mother. His response was that he already was looking at her and that he didn't know whether or not she was involved. Now, I just want to play you this clip from a TV news interview with Donald from around that time. I'll have the whole video on our website because just listening to it doesn't quite capture the disdain he clearly has. But trust me, it's there.
The other side of the family, meaning Lee's mother and stepfather, are they going to join you all in any of these searches? Have you heard?
Not that I'm aware of. If they do, it's going to be a surprise to me.
So I showed you the actual video, so you saw Donald.
Yeah, I mean, it was very much a look of, I don't really know how to describe it. He kind of snickered with this, like, a sense of, no, she's an evil bitch and won't help.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's kind of what I got.
Yeah, I got a little barely concealed rage.
Yeah.
In there. And yeah, like I said, I don't think they had a friendly relationship before this.
Doesn't seem like it.
And so, yeah, I don't think that it became friendlier. So let's talk about Vicky. Vicky Felton has never been charged with anything, nor has she ever officially been named a suspect. She has also always maintained that she had nothing to do with her daughter's disappearance. And shortly after Lee went missing, she actually increased the reward to find her and hired a private investigator. However, in 2017, Detective Aguirre, who by then was Chief Aguirre, he was chief of the Tupelo Police Department, was interviewed by the Sun-Herald for the 25th anniversary. In that article, he said, quote, "I would consider her a person of interest. You still can't eliminate her. There are still too many unanswered questions for Vicky, and I don't know if that is unusual for somebody to go off to work and say, well, I just left Lee, but I'm going to call and check on her. Why check on her that soon after she just left her?" End quote. Now, the failed polygraph probably didn't help Aguirre erase her from that list either. And the two subsequent polygraphs that the FBI gave her that she also failed were probably pretty damaging as well. Now, polygraphs aren't admissible, of course, but three failed ones is not a good look.
I'd be curious to know what questions she specifically showed deception on.
Yeah, and they never say what specific questions it is. And Vicky said, well, yeah, I failed them because, like, I was anxious and I was talking about my missing daughter and, you know, whatever.
I'll give that to her.
On the first one, sure, because that was really shortly after.
Yeah.
But, like, the two subsequent ones with the FBI, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I would even give her a little bit of leeway on that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I would be curious if it was the very specific question, did you have anything to do with your daughter going missing? Because I'm sure that they would have, I'm sure they would have asked that question exactly like that.
Right.
And if that was the same question that she showed deception on three times in a row, like, that's pretty indicative.
Yeah, that does not look good. People, of course, also point to her demeanor. as being suspicious. She appeared on the news several times, of course, especially in the early days, you know, asking for her daughter to be returned and things like that. And she wasn't hysterical. She was very calm. She wasn't crying. And people are like, oh, well, you don't care. You don't love your daughter. You did it, blah, blah, blah. I never put stock in any of that.
Because nobody knows how they're going to react in a situation like this unless they're in it.
Exactly. And according to her ex-husband, she was a trained interrogator in the Army. So she has been trained to maintain her wits in stressful situations, right. One can assume, right? And every news clip I've seen of her, she's been calm and has just kind of said what she needed to say, put the information out there. And I even played one for you.
Yeah.
It was right before the Dawn clip. And yeah, like I get why people look at that and are like, that's not how a mother should act or whatever. But I can also see it as an attempt to have effective messaging and a belief that crying over your daughter won't bring her back, but telling neighbors to check their sheds and their outbuildings might.
Yeah.
So like that part, I don't put any stock into it. And, you know, I'm not saying that means she's innocent either, but no. Like it definitely to me does not point to her guilt.
Right.
But one thing that we can't forget is that there were allegations of abuse in her household. And on top of that, when something happens to a child, statistically, it's because of somebody close to her. The timeline is tight, but people have pointed to her going to work and then immediately going home and quote unquote discovering that Lee was missing as her attempt to control the scene and control the narrative.
Right.
However, Vicky has spent decades pointing at a specific, credible, alternative suspect. His name was Oscar McKinley Kearns. People called him Mike. And there's a lot to talk about when it comes to Mike. And this is the rabbit hole that I fell down. So right now, at this point in the story, it looks like Vicky is the most viable suspect. And listen, I'm not saying that part two is going to exonerate her, but I do think it's going to give all of us some food for thought. So for those of you who are on Patreon, you'll be able to access it early as soon as I can get it up. But for everyone else, we'll see you here next week. Lee Ochi has been missing from Tupelo, Mississippi since August 27, 1992. She is a white female with blonde hair and hazel eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 4 feet 10 inches tall and weighed about 95 pounds. She has a strawberry birthmark at the base of her skull, small scratch scars on her right leg, and pierced ears. Lee was 13 years old when she went missing. She would be 46 today. If you have any information on the disappearance of Lee Ochi, please contact the Tupelo Police Department at 662-841-6491 or Crime Stoppers of Northeast Mississippi at 1-800-773-TIPS. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for part two.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!